six-week precious metals winning streak continued amid renewed EU banking concerns. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend. We have another edutainment-packed show, including guest interviews from the leading financial gurus and economic headlines with analysis for your portfolio. Richard Doughty, a.k.a. the Magambo, says, "He who owns the gold makes the rules." The precious metal shorts are running scared after making dangerous bets against real money, the only safe haven in interesting times. Huge government debts virtually guarantee currency default, making gold and silver the perfect escape capsule for every investor. Eventually, our officials will return to a sound money standard, the same mechanism that brought us the economic miracle early on in this nation. And prices for everyday goods and services will continue to rise, culminating with a dangerous cycle of runaway inflation. Then Bill Murphy from Gotta.org says the gold cartel is losing control of the markets, as seen in the multi-week price explosion from support levels. Price suppression is nearing its end. Even central banks are finding it hard to procure gold amid continuing repatriation issues. Also, J.P. Morgan may have purchased most available silver and then sold short 3 to 5 times as much paper silver, which could explain the unusual premium activity he sees. However, the bank is running out of physical silver and ammunition and losing control, so these discounted prices could soon be a relic of the past. And before we begin today, I'd like to share food for thought via one of my favorite quotes from Albert Einstein. We've heard so many of them over the years, but have you heard this one? "Nothing will benefit human health and increase the chances for survival of life on Earth as much as an evolution to a vegetarian diet." Here's a few other great thinkers who also gave up on meat eating. You're bound to find someone in this list that you're fond of. Leonardo da Vinci, Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison, Pythagoras, Van Gogh, Charles Darwin, Gandhi, Mark Twain, Kafka, Srinivasa Ramanujan, Linus Pauling, Albert Schweitzer, Benjamin Franklin, and most of us know Steve Jobs, Sir Isaac Newton, Copernicus, and the early Christians, even Jesus, were all vegetarians. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the Market Weather Report. Well, visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week. The longest winning streak in nearly 3 years continued on gold positive news again from the Fed in support of sustained low lending rates. On Friday, the yellow metal closed at a new 16-week high, the best run since 2011. At Friday's closing bell in the New York COMEX exchange, investors turned to gold again, which added about $16, finishing at $13.40. The yellow metal is higher for the year by over 10%. Silver gained about 30 cents, ending at just shy of $21.50. Palladium picked up 13, closing at $8.72. The metal is in a massive bull run. Let's hope that it's a precursor to what we'll see soon in gold and silver, and finished at the best point in nearly 14 years on continued supply concerns from Russia, the world's top source of the metal. Platinum futures for also climbed about $15 to $15.16 an ounce, breaking that resistance area on the NYMEX. The best price in about a year. Well, West Texas Intermediate crude was down about 3 points, ending just above $100 a barrel. Well, one of the top stories moving the markets this week stemmed from the Federal Reserve, which caught investors off guard with further dovish talk. Apparently, the Fed governors are backing the sentiments of the new Fed chair, Dr. Yellen, who suggested at the last FOMC meeting that interest rate increases were unlikely. Plus, renewed debt concerns from the Eurozone, this time over Portugal and its Banco Espírito Santo, or Bank of the Holy Spirit, whose parent company missed payments on short-term bonds. Company bonds plunged to record lows on the news. Investors were increasingly nervous that the Euro region remains vulnerable to financial shocks. Nevertheless, the event is likely overblown given that exposure by lenders to the region is reportedly low and the European Central Bank has recently announced contingencies to support member banks. All this according to a Goldman Sachs press release. Shifting the focus to west of the Eurozone region, news from Ukraine and the 4-month-long regional conflict is catching the attention of astute shoot investors. This week, separatists used their Air Force-related weaponry to attack Ukrainian forces and to seize a town, killing 50 troops, despite the threat of increased sanctions from the European Union. Adding to geopolitical strife, tensions are escalating in the Middle East once again, with Israel marshaling 20,000 combatants for a possible ground invasion of the Gaza Strip to halt a barrage of rocket bombardments. I hope that David does not swallow the lure and succumb to the son of Goliath's trap here. Further south in the Middle East, sparks are flying perilously close to the Middle Eastern powder keg, with Sunni tribes battling the Shiite-led Iraqi government, demanding that the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki step down. Elsewhere, global ETF bullion holdings continue to improve, climbing to an 8-week high point, including assets in the Spider Gold Trust. Not only gold and silver ETF holdings are on the rise, but the other white metal, platinum, and palladium are experiencing surpluses in ETF stockpiles. This positive sign was bolstered by the fact that the metals typically find a bottom, usually sometime between July and October. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, gold and silver continued higher. As foretold in last week's Alpha Stocks newsletter, equities market weakness combined with geopolitical tensions on at least three major fronts are the ideal conflagration to put a solid floor under the precious metals sector. In fact, the bears mauled the market three times over the past year and failed to force bulls to capitulate in every instance, indicative of solid underlying support. Dollar cost averaging is advisable at these levels. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange, with the two major indices recoiling from all-time record highs last week. For the week, the Dow was off only 124 points, ending just shy of 17,000. The S&P 500 lost 17, wrapping up at 1967, while the Nasdaq shed 70, ending at 4415. Well, Thursday, the financial health of a major Portuguese lender roiled global equities markets, particularly in Southern Europe, which then spilled over across the pond to North America, which sent capital flowing into the precious metals sector. Portugal's benchmark index was hit hardest, losing about 4.2% on the news, while Spain and Italy weren't too far behind with around 2% losses. IPOs were canceled in Southern Europe, and investors fretted over a possible repeat of the 2011 European banking crisis. In a statement on Thursday, the International Monetary Fund and EU bankers noted that pockets of vulnerability remain. Banco Espirito Santo's shares have been under pressure since May. The bank disclosed that an audit by the Bank of Portugal showed that there was a serious financial condition by its holding bank and extreme accounting irregularities, making holders of short-term bond securities that much more nervous. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our seven-component sentiment index pendulum has finally started to budge from one of the more extreme, overzealous positions we've seen in years. There's still a high level of optimism, despite all the volatility that came into the markets this week. Just too much to call a bottom, even though we're seeing signs of accumulation already in this amazing market. Still a little bit too early for me to call a weekly bottom here, until I see some more of this optimism diminish. After the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Bill Murphy from Gata and La Metropole Cafe, as well as the Magambo guru, Richard Doughty. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Mm-hmm. Joining me in a discussion on the precious metals markets, Bill Murphy from the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell. Welcome, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You know, at least six measures on monetary policy are being proposed to Congress. This is a somewhat new story. You may not have come across it yet. Apparently, they're going to try to get these rules in there for approval. What do you think?
The rich and powerful and everything. I just did a wonderful show with Naomi Prinz, and is a great author and a Wall Street person and understands all of this stuff. And all Wall Street and Washington about is the money and power and to maintain it. And all this other stuff is window dressing, and nothing ever happens that really counts that can make a difference or change, again, the rich and powerful from doing whatever they want to do.
Well, you know, another interesting story recently, apparently officials in Europe have changed their mind regarding their gold stockpile held here in the United States. Germany's gold reserves were sent all that was held in the Paris vaults, but only about 5 tons from the United States. They seem to be changing tack here on their desire for the repatriation of their gold reserves from the U.S. Do you think that somebody has twisted their arm a bit?
Chris, it is so silly. It is so obvious what's going on, and I'm going to talk to your listeners from a GATA standpoint. The gold cartel's in big trouble. They can't give the German gold back. India's trying to change what it's doing, swapping stuff with England here and there. ECB came, I don't know, a couple of months ago about saying what they're doing in the market. The gold and silver markets are getting ready to blow up. The gold cartel, the manipulators, the price suppressors, are about to hit the wall. It'll be gradual. It'll happen overnight. But they're desperate. That's why the German thing has come out the way it has. These people are pitiful, and it's going to be the biggest scandal in U.S. history, and it's coming. I can't tell you it's going to happen tomorrow, but it's coming. Even recently, they tried to get gold down below 1310 over and over again, comes back up. Silver's acting differently than it has in 3 years. 95% of the access market openings in the last 2 months have been lower. 95%. No market ever trades like that. They're trying to influence it.
You know, it's interesting you would note that, because we hear another story here recently that the Reserve Bank of India, their central bank, has plans to swap some of its gold in vaults, you know, under the central bank. Apparently, they want to help with what is being called a shortage in London for gold. And, you know, this to me has the sound of desperation.
You have it nailed, Chris, and I think we're right about there. These people are desperate. They managed to mobilize. We wanted to get into that, what they did, how to get gold bit down from 1900. And they've used every trick in the book, and it worked, and they're running out of what I call ammo. And that's why silver is trading so differently than it has for 3 years. They're doing that now for a month or two, totally differently. And I think you're getting ready for a price explosion. And I have a theory behind it. I write it in my Metropole Cafe commentary, what's going on. And I think we have something that is explosive. And I must say, the sentiment is the most bearish from my world in 16 years in terms of the general public interest in gold and silver. Never seen anything like it this bad.
From a contrarian perspective, that couldn't be any better.
You couldn't have a better setup than you have right now. There's nobody home. Nobody's paying attention.
According to one report, the offtake of bullion from the Shanghai Gold Exchange exceeded 1,000 tons. And that's just in 6 months. Clearly, the smart money, the global money, knows that the game is almost up here. If the pace continues, according to the article, it will absorb all of the gold that's been produced. And keep in mind, I want our listeners to know, if they don't already, that last year, China absorbed most, if not all, of the global production. And keep in mind, they produce more than any other nation as well. If we look at their track record in the recent decades, they are the go-to people to be monitoring. I mean, they don't make mistakes. Obviously, they know something that the rest of us need to be paying attention to. What do you think?
Well, I can tell you this. I've had 3 conference calls with the Chinese Investment Corporation, one of their 2 sovereign wealth funds. They know what GATA knows. The Russians have been talking about GATA since 2004. And then we talked about Andrei Baikov, the top economic aide to Putin, in two of our conferences. He knows what God knows. We know Putin knows what God knows. They all know it's coming. Only the West is just clueless because of the press and the money and power that, you know, tries to downplay gold and what's going on and give out disinformation. You've got absolute explosions coming, and you're correct. Chinese are eating it all up. Anyone who follows this stuff knows what's going on. The demand is just devouring the plans of the gold cartel, and they are in big trouble.
You know, I'd like to return for a moment to silver. According to an interesting report here, the Got Gold report, the big money, the smart money, is covering massive silver shorts at a record clip. They're getting nervous. This type of behavior, this type of action, it takes time. It's not something you don't cover these massive positions overnight. It certainly could lead to a big squeeze, at least some folks are calling for here, the Got Gold report, in silver. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think we have a squeeze coming. J.P. Morgan has won for 3 years in a row. I have a theory that the premiums for 2 or 3 years ago were to never been. There was a shortage. It was a problem. Everyone was talking how bullish the market was. It was because, in my, this is just my thought now, J.P. Morgan bought up all the silver near the highs and on that area, then put about 3 or 4 or 5 times that much out on the short side in the paper market, derivatives market. And then bond the market, hitting the market with the physical silver they had, making 3 to 5 times as much money in their derivative position. And now they're running out of that supply, and that's the reason silver is trading so differently. So now you don't see any shortages. You don't see any premiums, and everybody's going, well, it's no big deal. You won't see that until after silver starts to explode again. But the smart money, when the guys that you're talking about, who got buried by Morgan for all these years, are now taking them on. And if I'm correct, and we'll see, silver's about to explode. If it takes out 22, next stop is 26. It takes that out, then you're looking at 50, then 100.
We have a trend line, as you say, right there around that 21, 22 area. The trading range gets more and more narrow. And, of course, that just leads to spring-like action. You think of it as a coiled spring winding, winding. Once you take out that level, things happen in a very fast way. Do you want to really be buying at 23, 25, 26, 30, 40, and 50? A great time for discount prices. I mean, we're 3 years into this correction. You know, the head of Tocqueville Gold Fund Manager, John Hathaway, recently noted that paper gold is not going to be of any value to most investors by the time they really need it.
Well, I had the pleasure of having dinner with John many years ago, and he's a great guy. He had his assistant, Doug Groh, come to our 2005 conference in the Yukon, and lovely people, and they're smart as can be. And from my standpoint, we know that much of the physical gold has been compromised over and over again, hypothecated, rehypothecated, and it's not there. And when the real scramble comes to get the physical gold that you think you own, it's going to create a panic. It will cause force majeures, and it will expose this whole gold fraud for what it is. And it's coming, and the timing is difficult, but it's coming.
Interesting. And as we wrap up here, you know, Gerald Celente recently told us that he suspects all the gold in central bank coffers, for the most part, is gone. It's just a bunch of swaps and paper promises. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, my opinion has been for years that it's supposedly now that central banks say they have 28,000 tons of gold, and I don't think they have 10,000 tons left or somewhere around there. So I wouldn't say going to the zero area, but I mean, it's down to a point where it is catastrophic, and that's why the Germans can't get their gold back, and that's why I'm saying it's going to be the biggest financial scandal in the U.S., maybe in the world, when this whole thing blows up, and it's going to blow up. People will not believe what's coming. Now, it could be a couple of months from now or a couple of years from now, but it's coming. The timing is so difficult, as we all know.
And you know, the interesting side note here, if you will, our walkaway point, is we have $3 trillion in pension funds sitting just in Japan alone. The Eurozone, half a billion people there, and much of the rest of the world or the United States. All that money is getting nervous because they know interest rates at some point have to go up. It may not be by choice, but rates one day will go up. And when they do, my suspicion is we haven't even seen the fireworks.
Yeah, but that's very good speculation. That's what's coming.
People keep thinking, well, you know, higher rates, bad for gold. Really?
That's not what happened in the 80s.
Yeah, the 70s and 80s. I mean, look at the 70s. People associate higher rates with Paul Volcker, right? You know, Dr. Volcker, when he said, well, we're going to turn it up here to about 18 to 20%. Well, sure, they slammed the brakes. But, I mean, people forget that rates were rising, as you pointed to, all throughout the 70s. All right, Bill Murphy, tell folks more about La Metropole Cafe, please, and Gata.
Well, you can sign up to go to Gata.org and sign up for a free mailing list. My colleague Chris Powell does a great job. We sell a lot of good stuff. And I have a subscription site. You can go to LaMetropoleCafe.com and sign up for a two-week free trial and see if it's worth paying for.
We're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Okay, Chris. Take care.
Head of the Got Gold Report says short covering in gold futures by managed money is the new theme replacing the short gold mantra. In other words, the shorts are running scared, the bears are running back to their caves. The Magambo Guru publishes the Magambo Guru Economic Newsletter, and he has made some time for us here today. Welcome back, Richard.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Good to have you back. You know, Richard, James Turk also announced that, well, he's not so worried about the gold market anymore. You know, most estimates are showing that the paper market money is 10 times the size of the futures that they're controlling. He also is calling for a short squeeze.
Desperate people are going to do desperate things. So, yeah, it's going to get even weirder from here, Chris. I'll tell you, these guys are really made a bad bet, and things are unraveling a lot faster than anybody thought they would.
But, you know, it hasn't been such a bad bet. At least it wasn't for two and a half years or so. I mean, it was the theme out there. You know, eventually there's going to be some big blowback. And it looks like it's not like one of us here with an E-Trade or Schwab or TD Ameritrade account quickly click a button or put in a buy stop or something and we're out of our short positions. They swing a heavy line, as Jesse Livermore used to say it. They're not pikers, as he would also say. You can't just quickly unwind positions overnight. This could be setting the stage for some interesting market moves, don't you think?
Yes, it could be some very interesting market moves. And as far as the bet against gold being a good one, I'm reminded of the saying, you're only as good as your last trade. So where are you sitting right now? So these guys, yes, they made some bad bets. And they're sitting on top of it. They're going to get out from under this somehow.
Well, speaking of bad bets, John Paulson, the supposedly brilliant hedge fund manager who shorted the housing market at the peak using special derivatives from his friends at Goldman Sachs. Since then, his funds have done nothing but dwindle. After 12 years of losing their shirts, know, they got lucky. Let's hope that their luck has run out because that's our lucky day, and enough of that. All right, I also wanted to ask you about comments from John Embry. He's another friend of the show here. He's saying that behind the scenes, there are just unpayable debts that our central banks have accumulated. You can count on a serious rally. One side of the balance sheet is overwhelmed with debt. Something has to come back into balance.
Yes, I have a lot of thoughts. Yes, equilibrium must be restored. All the money that has been created to date, all that debt, all $60 trillion of it, has all mostly been borrowed. There's a few dollars around in actual dollar bills and spare change. But the rest of it is basically debt that is owed somebody. And there's just not enough money being generated by the system to pay the big on all those debts. See, something big is going to happen very soon when they can't pay their debts. It's en masse. I mean, things are getting bad everywhere you look. It just people are spending less. The Gallup polls show that people are spending less now than they did in 2008 per day. Businesses are failing. More businesses are failing than they're being created. It just everywhere you look, it just things are falling apart, and the reason is because the federal government has created through the Federal Reserve so much money, Chris, that it's just the debt. That's all debt. People owe $60 trillion. The GDP of the United States is about $15 trillion, so we owe four times as much as we make gross.
And that's, I think, a conservative estimate, because if we add in some of the other unfunded liabilities they refer to it, isn't that, that's a funny moniker, isn't it? Yeah, I wish I could just go to my bank and say, you know, I can't make the mortgage, I can't make the rental payment this month because I just have some unfunded liabilities. And it's a little worse than people, because they forget about Medicaid and they forget about Medicare and they forget about some of these other issues going on. Let's also not forget we have FHA, Fannie, Freddie, and so many others there, Sallie Mae. You add them all up, and now this is according to Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who will be a guest here on the show, I think it's next week, that we're talking about as much as $200 to $222 trillion, more than 10 times the current national debt, which is what, 17, 18 trillion at last check. Imagine if what you owed on your house was 10 times your salary. No bank would give you a loan on a $1 million house if all you're making is $100,000 a year. They'd laugh you out of the place. Because everyone knows it's supposed to be about 3 to 1. Any way you slice it, depending on what you want to include or exclude from the equation, we have serious domestic problems. And guess what? Everybody has drunk this Kool-Aid, haven't they, Richard?
Pretty much everybody. But that was the way everybody wanted it to go. Remember, the whole housing crisis was basically caused by the Congress passing the Community and Reinvestment Act that forced banks to make loans at rates below where they could break even on the risk. And so they had to offload all these derivatives. I mean, it just goes on the corruption all the way through the system, trying to get this thing going, trying to get this thing from collapsing, because so many people are owed so much money, and they owe so much money themselves. I mean, I have a gigantic amount of debts I owe, and a lot of other guys owe me a lot of money, and they can't pay me. Is to get in debt like this when the Constitution itself would have prevented it by making money only silver and gold. They could not have increased the money supply enough to make all this possible. None of this would have been possible if we'd had a stable money supply. We wouldn't be here at all.
This is what we've talked about here on this show for 9 years, so I'm going to spare my longtime listeners with a diatribe about, you know, what happened in the 17, 1800s. But I mean, a quick little synopsis here for our new listeners. For my new listener. And that is that they were witnessing first what had happened in France. If for no other reason, they wanted to protect their own necks from the guillotine, because they saw that the leaders of the day who spend profligately, they found their heads separated from their bodies. If they cared nothing about the progeny, and I think they actually did somewhat, they'd seen multiple revolutions for an entire century in France. And here we were building this nation up. And keep in mind, King Louis and Antoinette funded, and I want to get my number right here, 100 million livres, I hope I pronounced that correctly, to the United States. Because they were at war once again with Great Britain. You know, this is something we've got to keep in mind, and I've taken the scenic route. So let's get back on track here. An interesting story here this week, or at least recently. China apparently is going to drop its gold reserves a significant amount, as much as 400 tons. However, then we find out later on in another report that Shanghai Gold Exchange has had something like 947 tons. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that's approaching 1,000 tons. This report goes on to say that China will consume or absorb most, if not all, of the world's gold production. And keep in mind, they just did that last year. What do they know that we need to know?
What they know is what everybody really knows deep down in their hearts, that gold and silver are the only real money. It's the only ultimate money that there is. And the people all the way through history that have destroyed themselves with too much debt, the people that were saved, people had gold. And the economies that went under were basically ones who did not have a gold standard. He who owns the gold makes the rules. And so things are going to be happening pretty soon.
You might have read British MPs have called on the UK financial watchdog there, their little service, to investigate allegations of price rigging. We just recently hear that the silver fix soon will be closed down. I'm sure you read of this as well. It's kind of interesting. I don't know that it's all that significant, but you know, we've all been waiting, I think, since then to find out whether or not the gold market would follow suit in London, that they would break this gold fix. Well, there's been a lot of backlash regarding this, and apparently a lot of the producers don't want that. They want this fix in place. So we've got people lining up on both sides of the battlefield. The GATA folks and people like us who are saying, look, let these markets be free. You don't have price discovery when the market isn't free.
Well, you know, it would be kind of, things are going to collapse. That's the lesson of history. There's nothing anybody can do about it. So what more handy scapegoat could it be than to blame it all on these gold people, the gold-fixing people, and run them into jail? Who's in a content, all of the politicians say, hey, it wasn't our fault. We were misled and cheated by these gold-fixing people. There's all kinds of recriminations coming for all kinds of things. And the shifting of blame. Somebody's got to take the pipe for this. So I think that's just one more stooge, one more pigeon being led to slaughter.
Well, let's shift gears here for a moment. Focus in on the recent precious metals markets. You know, we heard from the Federal Reserve, the new Fed head, Dr. Janet Yellen, reiterating that the benchmark U.S. overnight lending rate is going to be held low. The markets, at least the gold market, like to hear that. I mean, it's clearly inflationary. Talk about taper this, taper that, all they want. But, you know, in the final analysis, what people care about are the rates. And I know you heard that the ECB also dropped their benchmark rate into negative territory. First time that a major bank has done this. We've got some nervous bankers here. This is what's been sending money from the globe into the U.S. equities markets that, you know, Europe, 500 million people there, larger than the U.S., half a billion folks, they want returns. And they see this U.S. equity market going up and their markets are stagnating because they're in the middle of a semi-recession. What do you think this means for the gold market, though? Do you think that Dr. Yellen is calling it as she sees it, that we need to keep rates low for a while, and that could be a positive?
Yeah, I think I take it from a more basic viewpoint. You say that the level of interest rates is what's important. I say, no, the cost of food and energy is what's important, and the whole world is going to react to that. They're going up. You can't stop it. That's the inevitable result of all this creating of money. And so prices are going to be going up. Then people really get nervous. And then people really won't want to hold any debt. And then interest rates will rise from there. Yeah, interest rates are basically driven by a lot of things other than the Federal Reserve, they have a lot of influence over some little interest rates. But when it comes to the big macro thing, it's can people feed their families and heat their houses and keep them cool and put gas in the car. And that stuff is going up like you wouldn't believe.
People wonder why we don't see lines wrapped around, soup kitchens like we did in the 30s. And they forget, well, there's 47 million food stamp holders in this country. And tired topic, so I won't even get into that right now. But I did want to ask you about something more topical. The Ukraine and Iraq. You know, these are two interesting wild cards. We saw considerable market backlash from both, and then it's kind of tapered off a bit. But, you know, they're sitting there in the background, both of them. The UK Telegraph comment that the Ukraine situation could easily become the focal point for the next Cold War between Russia and the West. Our Ukrainian neighbors who have a huge central area where they produce a massive amount of grain and wheat for not only Russia, but the rest of Europe. We forget about this. Russia, a very hungry nation for wheat and grain. We were their number one supplier for a long time. But then they have large natural gas reserves, and the pipelines run from Russia to Europe right through there as well. This is a strategic area. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, yeah, it's a big strategic area, but I think the ISIS people declaring a caliphate that ignores national boundaries, that's a big thing, too. So then it's just going all the way around the world. All that debt that people owe and the money, things cost so much more, it causes all the agitation. This is the natural order of things. I don't see what the problem is. I mean, it's always like this at the end of long booms when it starts breaking up.
You really have to wonder whether or not the central bankers will be able to hold things together. Creative destruction. You know, we have these massive Keynesian fomented booms, right, followed by these implosions. It kind of feels like we're at the end game here.
That's the whole lesson of the last 2,500 years of history. As one government after another bankrupted itself and they did everything possible to try to save themselves. England at one time tried to get Isaac Newton, the greatest mathematician and genius probably the world has ever known, working on the problem. He failed miserably. You can't stop it. That's the lesson of history. That's what the founding fathers knew. Once you start this thing, you can't stop it. It's the end of disaster, and the only way to stop it is to hold the money supply constant.
The only thing I'd add there is his niece commented about Uncle Isaac Newton. She said, you know, he was quite upset when he saw his fortune reversed in the South Sea bubble. He never cared much to talk about it. And I would just add one little anecdote here. I've got to throw this in here. His contemporary Leibniz, he wrote more than 1 million pages on science in his life. He wrote 10 pages minimum a day. He also discovered infinitesimal calculus, a differential calculus, on his own independently. And, of course, they fought bitterly over that their entire lives, Newton and Leibniz. Another interesting thing here, Leibniz independently created a computer. That's right. He created a mechanical calculator slash computer hundreds of years before even Alan Turing. So I just had to throw that in there because I think he's the unsung hero simply because he was so far ahead of his time. He was so far out there, and he had some kind of harebrained ideas with monads and all that stuff, metaphysics, and that really turned a lot of people off. Richard, I know you're going to want to leave some parting positive gold and silver comments for our listeners. What do you see coming? What do you see happening? And tell us why, please.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason why, I'll tell you off the top of my head, it's the same reason why all the way through human history, government after another, what people after another, one society after another, borrowed themselves an unpayable debt, they went bankrupt and there's nothing they can do. And the people who made out well were the people who owned silver and gold. And that's what I'm recommending. And my advice is, buy something today, and if you don't, then there's something wrong with you.
But what about gold envy? You know, I mean, if you really read between the lines in a lot of these texts that we've thumbed through over the years, you can't help but notice that those folks who were wise enough to take the precautionary measures that you are suggesting here, they had a tendency to be vilified and ostracized.
That's what the majority wants to believe, that there's such a thing as unlimited wealth from debt. I mean, it's so comforting. It's so wonderful. I mean, everybody makes so much money while it's going on. And so how could it be wrong? How can something that feels so right be so wrong? But they're wrong. And another lesson of history is the majority of investors have to be wrong, whatever it is they're thinking. They've been wrong about gold and silver all this time. So, yeah, they're going to have to. They're the ones that are going to come up with the profits that we holders of gold and silver are going to get.
Well, thank you for helping us be right instead of wrong.
You are definitely right, Chris. I'm behind you 100%, dude.
Thank you, sir, and have a good dinner.
Thank you. Wonderful. Nice. Wonderful talking to you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A MarketWatch.com article this week entitled, House Hearing Opens Pandora's Box of Fed Reform, reminded me of a poorly executed game of all-star wrestling, where the wrestlers, who are actually tumblers, pretend to spar and do harm with one another when in reality they are just play-acting in a predetermined role with a predetermined script designed to create and perpetuate a cultural myth they want their audience to simply believe. The House hearing on reforming the Federal Reserve makes for great theater. It makes people think there is actually the possibility of real change within the central bank. It fosters the illusion of choice. I mean, who could be against ending the revolving door between the Fed and the White House? Mark Calabria, Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute, stated that Congress should ban anyone who worked for the White House in the past 4 years from serving on the Fed board to make the central bank more independent from the executive branch. When he was questioned, he said he would be happy to expand that to Wall Street. It sounds great, but does it really change the essence of what the Fed really is? Another thought is to make the president of the New York Fed a presidential appointment. Simon Johnson, a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and now a professor at MIT, believes the anachronism in the 1913 legislation setting up the Fed is that Federal Reserve Bank presidents are not accountable to Congress and should be subject to Senate confirmation. Like, that will really matter. Yet another proposal is to give the San Francisco Fed a permanent vote on the Fed Policy Committee. Right now, the New York Fed votes at every Fed Policy Committee, and the other 11 district presidents rotate. It's believed that the San Francisco Fed should also get a permanent voting seat because the district bank represents 3 or 4 times the number of people as the New York Fed. This might be important from an internal Fed power position, but how does it help the economy or the people? It doesn't. It's more noise creating the illusion of choice, the sound of something happening. Another proposal suggests allowing Fed governors to have their own staff. The House bill would allow each Fed governor to have their own dedicated staff. Currently, the Fed chair has control over the central bank staff. The Cato Institute believes such a change would help reduce some of the groupthink that dominates the Fed, which is actually a good idea. But that doesn't pull much weight because the institution itself is actually private, masquerading as public or federal. Those who support this rhetoric said it would just require the Fed to be more transparent and denied they were meddling with the independence of monetary policy. Much is done in the form of debate and discussion to perpetuate the myth and illusion of free markets, independent monetary policy, and capitalism. The illusion of choice is alive and well. The House Republican Fed reform measure is another form of political discourse designed to keep us believing in distinctions without much of a difference. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
My my next special guest, Doug Casey from Casey Research. Welcome back.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, you're on record recently with a call for higher prices worldwide. Others expect the Fed to continue tapering. They've done so three times now. Who do you think will ultimately be correct here? Will it be the deflationists or the inflationists?
It's been a battle, a titanic battle, between inflation and deflation that's been going on since the devaluation of the dollar in 1971, when the final link was gold and therefore the final restraint on how many currency units they could create was broken. One thing you can rest assured of, I think, is that we're facing some type of a financial catastrophe. And whether it's deflationary in nature or inflationary or both in sequence is still an open question. They've greatly increased since the Greater Depression, and I do call it the Greater Depression, started in 2007. Is they've greatly increased their creation of currency units. Now, for a while, it was running $85 billion per month of new money, where the Fed would buy paper, mortgage paper, government debt paper, all kinds of things, and credit the accounts of the sellers with the new dollars that they created. Now, they've reduced that to $65 billion temporarily, but still, they're greatly increasing. It's hard to say. The one thing they are doing is they're discouraging people from saving, because it makes no sense to save with 1% interest rates, because that's part of the raison d'etre for what they're doing, is to decrease interest rates, hoping for people to consume more. And they're creating bubbles. Right now, the biggest bubble in the world is in the bond market. This is potentially a much bigger catastrophe than the bubble they created in the stock market, which collapsed in 2001, or the bubble they created in real estate, which collapsed in 2007. So is it going to be inflation or deflation, or both at once in separate sectors of the economy, or in sequence? Still an open question. Just look for financial chaos.
Chaos has certainly increased. I'm sure you've noticed in the past couple of decades. For the most part, we don't see these steady long-term trends that persisted over the last 30, 40 years. But there is one place that had remained stable, and that's the bond market. Are you watching that market for signs of cracks in the foundation?
The world is much more indebted now than it was even in 2007, when things very nearly came unglued, but were papered over by the creation of trillions of new dollars in the U.S., and the same thing in Europe and Japan and China. So they've reduced interest rates to near zero levels. And as interest rates go down, the prices of bonds move inversely. They've gone up. So at some point, interest rates are going to go back up. You've got to remember that interest rates were, even for U.S. government paper, depending on the length and the type, they range from 13, 14, 15, even 18% back in the early 80s. Now they're close to zero, or 1 or 2%. Interest rates, after going down for over 30 years, will eventually head back up, and that'll collapse the bond market. And all the people that are borrowing money now, borrowing for cars and for houses, won't be able to afford those things. So we'll have a resumption of the Greater Depression, more unemployment, bankruptcies, corporate failures. So we're just in the eye of the storm at the moment. We entered the storm in 2007. Now we're in the eye of the eye of the hurricane. But we're going to come out very soon, I think, to the trailing edge of the hurricane, and it's going to be much, much worse and more turbulent and much, much longer lasting than what we saw in 2008 and 2009.
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting transition into the next question. You know, inflation is certainly good for precious metals. The sector tends to outperform most other competing asset classes when prices are on the rise. Do you expect the metals to retest the 2011 bull market zenith, or will we remain within this broad consolidation and trading range for several more years?
I think it's wise to put these prices in perspective. And in 2001, I was on record as saying that both gold and silver in 2001, when they were about $250 and about $4 respectively, were cheaper in real terms than they were in 1971, before the devaluation, when you could buy them both at $35 and $1.29. They were actually cheaper then. Since then, their prices have gone up, gold from $250 to $1,900, and now it's backed off. So it's not at the giveaway levels that it was back in 2001, basically the cheapest levels in history, even though it was selling at $250 an ounce. But at $1,300 or whatever it is at the moment, it's a very reasonable value, and you should be buying for reasons of prudence and safety and insurance. Not necessarily capital gains and speculative gains as was possible 10 or 12 years ago. But that said, I'm a buyer. It's going to go higher in both real and nominal terms because there's going to be a panic into precious metals at some point as people want to get out of these debasing paper currencies. And this is true not just of the dollar, but of all paper currencies around the world.
We're in a much different world than we were, obviously, about 35 years ago, the last bull market peak in 1980. Nowadays, we do have ETFs. If your worst-case scenario does come to pass as outlined, would you expect for the paper schemes, if you will, to lose their efficacy at shielding investors from higher prices?
When it comes to ETFs, most of them, I don't know whether they actually have the gold in vaults that they add to as people put more money into the ETFs, or whether they're just hedging themselves in the futures market. So I prefer the physical metal, not a promise from some third party out there who may or may not have the financial wherewithal to make good if the market goes the wrong way on them. But the answer to the question is that first and foremost, everybody should buy physical gold in their own possession and keep it in the safest place they can think of. So that's the foundation. The second level would be to have more physical gold outside your home country, because it's critical to diversify internationally, diversify politically, because the political dangers in the world are even greater than the investment dangers. So have some of your gold outside of your home country. A third level is you can use things like goldmoney.com or the Hard Assets Alliance, and they'll store the gold for you in physical form outside your home country. And then for trading purposes, not a long-term holding, then use the ETFs. So I put them last on the term pole, and as I said, for short-term speculation only.
You know, for lower net worth individuals, there are some interesting new options to move precious metals offshore without having to go through the tedious process of selling what you own currently and then having to repurchase in another country. Apparently, Brinks has an excellent program now in place with the Brinks Vault in Montreal, as well as other Canadian vaults as well. And just the small net worth individual can pay as little as $20, $30 a month and have their, let's say, 10 silver 100-ounce bars in Montreal. So I just wanted to toss this out there for our listeners today who maybe are interested in dipping their toe in the water. It's not as diversified as, let's say, Panama or Switzerland or something of that nature, but it might get the ball rolling in the event that capital controls were to become more strict, as many folks are forecasting. Gold stocks are typically viewed as leveraged gold and silver plays. So far, 2014 is shaping up to be one of the best years in quite some time for XAU. It's certainly a robust sector. Tell folks what has renewed your interest in the precious metal stocks, please.
First of all, the mining stocks should not be considered investments. They're really speculations. This is why Benjamin Graham never talked about them in his book, and why Warren Buffett never deals with them. There's too much unpredictability about them, And basically, gold mining is not, quote-unquote, like owning a gold mine. It's really become a volatile, low-margin, unpredictable business. They're speculations. They're not investments. That said, the volatility of mining stocks is a good thing, not a bad thing, because the sector, and the sector that I'm interested in is the mining exploration stocks, most of which, incidentally, I've got to say, are worthless. But still, they trade, and they're extraordinarily volatile. It's possible to get returns of 10 to 1, 50 to 1, 100 to 1, and I hate to say it, but it's true, 1,000 to 1. And as we speak now, they're just coming off of their lowest bottom in history, in real terms. So the odds favor people that speculate in them now doing extremely well in the next few years. So I'm very friendly towards them, and I'm buying them.
Excellent. That'll be music to our listeners' ears. You've also noticed in recent discussions that the world's banking system is bankrupt, that the central banks do still own the electric printing presses, so we must start producing real goods and services, not just stocks and financial products. Could you tell us more, please?
One comment I've got to make is that the entire financial sector of the world is greatly overblown. Something like 22% of the market value of the world's stock markets is in banks, brokerage firms, and other financial institutions. I don't know what, if we lived in a free market, that percentage would be, but my guess is like a fraction, perhaps 10% of what it is, like 2% of the value of markets, because banks and brokers don't produce anything. They just shuffle money. And one of the problems in an inflationary economy that we're in right now, so it's inflated this whole area, the whole finance. It's a bubble. And one thing I don't want to touch right now are bank stocks and brokerage stocks. Most of them are bankrupt, and their market values are way out of proportion to what it seems to me they would be in a free market society. In addition to the fact that, at least until recently, when kids have started to realize that going to college is almost certainly a misallocation of their time and money, everybody wanted to become a banker, which is another sign of a bubble in the area.
You're also calling for a greater depression, worse than the 1930s, and that there is just a mound of personal, corporate, and federal debt that could capsize the entire system. Folks have just been living beyond their means. I wonder if you could highlight what listeners should expect under this scenario and maybe some precautions that could be taken right now.
Well, yes, let me define the word depression. It's a word that's used occasionally, not too much. People don't like to even think about a depression, so they call it a recession. But a depression is a period of time when most people's standard of living drops significantly. From that point of view, I'd say that we definitely entered what I call the Greater Depression in 2007. And debt is a real indicator of financial problems. Why? Because when you have debt, it means that you've been either consuming capital that somebody else has saved in the past, or you're mortgaging your future and money that you'll earn in the future. Savings is a sign that you've been producing more than you're consuming, and setting that aside. Debt is a sign that you've been consuming more than you're producing. And so with the world in debt, as much as it is, it means that we've been living out of capital or mortgaging our future. It's a potential catastrophe when everybody realizes it's run over the edge of the cliff and there's nothing below them. And that's where we are right now. I don't see any way back or around without a real reset in the world's financial and economic system. It's very, very serious, this debt thing.
It certainly is. And, you know, one way outside of the debt system, at least some pundits have pointed to, is gold. I mean, it's certainly been the go-to asset class of the last 15 years or so. But even the most staunch gold investor, they've lost their conviction. It's been shaken, at least somewhat, since 2011. I wonder if you could tell listeners how these discounted prices could be better than we did in the early stage of the last two gold markets.
Well, look, I really like to buy things when they're cheap, not when they're expensive. And I really like to be, to try to be, it's hard to be, but I like to try to be a contrarian. And I don't like to chase trends after they've been going on for too long and there's a mania building up. And the important thing to remember about gold is it's the only financial asset that's not simultaneously somebody else's liability. And in a world with a quadrillion, that's to say $1,000 trillion worth of derivatives floating around there, giant daisy chains where somebody owes somebody else and owes somebody else and owes somebody else, the whole system could come apart from one default or two defaults, and then it's a daisy chain. And that's why you want gold, because it's a financial asset that's not somebody else's liability. And we don't know exactly how much gold there is above ground in the world, but a very fair guess is about 6 billion ounces have been mined in all of history. In other words, something less than 1 ounce for every human being on the planet. So when you look at it that way, and you take the... That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you look at the number of U.S. dollars that, let's say, just the U.S. dollars outside of the United States, which people don't have to own, which they Americans do, but foreigners hold it just for their convenience. Say about 8 trillion U.S. dollars outside the U.S. Just if those dollars were to be redeemed with gold, you do the division, and you're looking at a big number, not counting the dollars inside the U.S. So I have to be bullish on gold. I'm just forced to be.
Well, you also say that the 2008 credit crisis was merely an interlude to a far more devastating economic plunge. We're still in the biggest bubble in world history, you've said, bigger than even the tech stock market bubble around the turn of the last century. It's bigger than even the real estate bubble or the bond bubble. Interest rates ranging from 0 to a few percent. This is the biggest bubble in history, and when it collapses, you've said it's going to be catastrophic because the bond market is so large. Please elaborate.
Yes, and the bond market is the largest market in the world. And since all the governments of the world, almost all, I have a few exceptions, government of Norway, the government of Singapore, there are a few others, but really all the governments of the world are bankrupt. They have liabilities and obligations that they've promised their subjects vastly in excess of the capital they have to make good on them. So this is why they're printing up currencies. And incidentally, all the central banks in the world have U.S. dollars and U.S. Treasury securities as major backing for their own currencies. So if the U.S. dollar blows up, it's going to take all the other currencies around the world down with it. And it's going to be a worldwide thing. In other words, I live in Argentina a good part of the year, and I love it. Fantastic country to live in. The government here is in their economic policies, but it doesn't bother me at all. It inures to my benefit. So the point I'm making is this. If the financial system in Argentina blows up, so what? It's just one little country, and foreigners take advantage of that by bringing capital in and buying things at bargain prices. No problem. However, if the United States blows up, it's a very different thing, because U.S. paper underlies all the other world currencies. And if that blows up, everybody loses their savings in the banking system. And corporations go bankrupt, the stocks become worthless. It'll become a worldwide phenomenon. So this is potentially much more serious than what the world faced in the 1930s. Much more serious. This is bigger than the tulip bubble in Europe. In addition to the fact that all these governments, when things go wrong, they tend to want to blame somebody else. And it's most convenient to blame another country for bringing the price of oil over $100 a barrel, for creating all kinds of cheap, good products for people to buy, putting American workers out of business because they're too inefficient to compete with them. So this is how wars start. And this is another element in the witch's brew.
Anything else that you're watching closely? Any other sectors that might be of particular interest?
Almost everything in the world is overpriced. Real estate's still overpriced because of, certainly in the U.S. and the developed world, because it floats on a sea of debt, which makes it very, very dangerous still. Stocks worldwide are, by all historic parameters, price-earnings ratio, price-to-book-value ratio, very overpriced, have no interest in them in general. And, of course, bonds are a terminal short sale. That said, there are always anomalies. For instance, on the Mongolian Stock Exchange, there's a little stock that's trading that's investing heavily in North Korea. You can buy it for a small fraction of its book value. Small market cap, it's hard to buy something on the Mongolian Stock Exchange, but there are anomalies like that around there. Well, just recently, price of coffee has doubled, and I thought that it was a fantastic pair trade to be long coffee. This was some months ago, and short Starbucks. And that worked out very well. So there's always speculative opportunities like that. And there will be more of them in the future. But right now, in general, I'd say you've got to be in these small gold mining stocks. They're really, really cheap. And it's likely that there's going to be a mania created in them over the next few years, cyclically.
I wonder if you could give the listeners an idea of some of the parameters that you like to watch when choosing. That could be a challenging sector to find those rare nuggets that do return as much as 100 to 1,000 fold the initial investment. The typical parameters that folks look for, the key ratios and financial metrics, it's just not adequate for pretty much separating the wheat from the chaff. Could you give folks an idea?
Yeah, no, you're quite correct about that. You can't use conventional security analysis in dealing with these things. They're generally a black hole for money. So we've developed what we call the eight P's that we always look at when we look at any of these little stocks. And there are about, I don't know how many, maybe 3,000 in the world. Most of them are traded in Canada, secondarily in the UK, Australia, and the US. But say 3,000 of them. And they all have gold or some other element to their name, but that's only on the share certificate. It's very rarely in the ground. And these eight P's we look at, it's a mnemonic. The first thing is people. We always look at the people in back of it. Are they competent? Are they honest? Do we know them personally, know how they think? This is by far the most critical thing, and you've got to have boots on the ground to be able to solve that part of the equation. Second thing is property. You've got to have some degree of geological competence where you can look at their property and see if it's possible that they have an economic resource there. Not just a resource, some element in the ground, but an economic resource that can be extracted profitably. Politics. I mean, what part of the world are they in? Is the government and the NGOs going to make it even possible or economic to mine this stuff? Financing, spelled with a PH, because this is a mnemonic. Can they raise the money to do this? Because it's no longer a question with mining of a couple guys with a mule going out and finding the treasure of Sierra Madre. This is a high-tech business, and it takes millions of dollars to do the prospecting with geophysics and geochemistry and so forth. Very different than it used to be. So there are a number of these things that we look at, and they're different to some degree than conventional securities analysis.
Very good. Well, we appreciate your time today. I wonder if you might tell listeners any contact information as well as the host of services that you provide.
Well, the name of the company is Casey Research, and If you go on our website, which is caseyresearch.com, we have a number of free publications, and they're actually extremely good, I've got to tell you. They're really, I'm very happy with them. And you can sign up for the free publications. And if you like the free publications and you agree with the way that we think, you might want to sign up for one of the investment recommendation publications. And I have a lot of videos on YouTube and so forth that go into the things we've been talking about in a different way and different angle. But this has been a very good interview. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, the pleasure is all ours, and we certainly hope that you'll return to GoldSeek.com radio soon.
Well, thanks for having me on.